90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Welcome to Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Today, our show is about a subject that I want to do for a long time. Not because of what is happening in the sports world, but to dispel some myths and untruths about domestic violence. Today, our guest is CEO of Hope House, Ms. Mary Ann Matheny, and she's a licensed clinical social worker. Good morning, Mary. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations.
Good morning.
And also, our intern is here this morning, Ms. Marvita Oliver. Good morning, Marvita. How are you doing this morning?
Thanks for letting me join in on this conversation.
So, you have worked at Hope House for a while, but can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, I have been there for a little while. I have a social work degree. I have a master's in social work and started out working with women and children, came to Hope House and was the first women's therapist that we had there, working in the shelter with the women, and then just kind of moved into different positions throughout the years and took over as CEO in 2006.
You have worked at Hope House since 1992, over 25 years.
Yep.
You started, as you said, a shelter therapist, and now you're a CEO. What do you enjoy most about your job and working at Hope House?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is the people that I work with. I am very, very blessed to have a wonderful staff that are very, very committed to helping people and helping to really break the cycle of domestic violence. So that's what keeps me going back each day and knowing that we're making a difference, knowing that we are helping people and having the ability to have contact with the clients that we serve. It's very rewarding.
What is Hope House?
Hope House provides services for victims of domestic violence, and we do that in a variety of ways. We have two emergency shelters with 122 beds between both of them, and then we have comprehensive outreach services. So we're working with people through the court system, at the hospital setting. We do individual and group counseling for adults and children. We have a safe visitation program. We have a very, very small transitional housing program and then a lot of advocacy and case management services that happen as well.
So you mentioned 122 beds. Are there times when Hope House is at capacity? Is 122 beds enough for Kansas City?
Well, no, it's not enough. We actually have six shelters in the metro area, and we all work very closely together. And between the six of us, we have 326 beds. And unfortunately, we are all full most of the time. So we could always use more, but economically, it's not feasible for us to be adding more beds at this time.
Why was Hope House started?
Well, Barbara Potts was the mayor of Independence at the time, and she had a lot of people in the community coming to her, talking to her about people in need, needing services, and there was nothing out in eastern Jackson County. She put a task force together, and within 6 months, they had the house donated, and January 1st of 1983, the doors were open.
How large of a problem is domestic violence in the Kansas City metropolitan area?
It's a huge problem here and across the country. Estimates are there are about 12 million people that are affected by domestic violence every year. So it's a huge problem. As I said, we have six programs here in the metro. We are all doing work to combat domestic violence, and we're all full. We're all at capacity. The numbers are really astronomical.
What is the mission of Hope House?
The mission of Hope House is to break the cycle of domestic violence. So we do that by providing those safe services, the services that we provide, and then education is another key component of that as well.
What is considered domestic violence? I know we've we'll talk about it briefly after that. We have a lot of questions with what's going on in the NFL, but what is considered domestic violence?
When we talk about domestic violence, often we're talking about the intimate partner violence. So you're talking about the power and control that happens within a relationship. So you don't have to be married, but having some sort of a relationship, boyfriend, girlfriend, girlfriend, it doesn't matter in that respect, but it's about the power and control that happens within that relationship. So one person in the relationship is exercising power and control over the other one.
So as we've all seen the videos with Kareem Hunt, and people say that's domestic violence, but as we were talking off air a little bit earlier, can you explain domestic violence and how that what he did and how that comes into that context?
Well, there's violence. There's just general violence that people have, that people are violent towards anyone. So they're violent towards people that they meet on the street or in a bar. So there's that kind of violence. And then domestic violence is really geared is towards that person who they're in the relationship with. It's not necessarily towards anyone else. It's towards that person in the relationship.
Well, Abby, do you have a question? Go ahead.
Yes. You mentioned that the mission of Hope House was to break the cycle and provide a safe place. When you're breaking the cycle, that means you're really committing yourself to educating the people involved. How long does that type of commitment take normally?
It varies. Mm-hmm. Statistics say that it takes an average of 7 times for someone to leave a relationship before they're able to leave for good. So depending on where we're meeting that person in their journey would determine how long it would take. Some of the other factors that happen is, what are their obstacles? What is it that's getting in the way of them leaving? So it could be that it's just they don't have the opportunity to leave, or it could be that they're not in a place yet to address all of the issues that are going on. So it can really take a very long time. Domestic violence is ugly, it's messy, it's deadly, and it's also very, very complicated.
Are there any types of things that are done with the individuals that are coming to help you to help them kind of get their minds clear to decide one thing or another?
Absolutely, and what our goal is to meet people where they are. So we don't go in with our own agenda or expectations of people. We go in asking them, what do they need, what do they want, what is it that they want to accomplish, and then we work with them there. But a key point of what we do is education, not of that person, so that they understand domestic violence themselves and that they understand what their choices are and what resources are available for them as well.
Who can be impacted from domestic violence? I know a lot of situations, is it just women only, or can men be also victims of domestic violence?
Absolutely. Women are most commonly the victims, so I think often when we talk about it, we talk about women being the victims, but men are victims as well.
Okay. I know there are times when people come together and go get counseling. What types of things are discussed in the counseling as far as what can people expect if they were to come to perhaps a counseling session where other women are around them? How can you describe that type of scenario?
So when we're working with people, we do it both on an individual basis and in a group setting. So in the individual session, it's really going to be what's going on with that individual person. What are they presenting with as what they want to address and what are their needs at that moment. And in the group sessions, it really would then become what the group is looking at. Groups can be very, very supportive. So you have people who have come in at different times. So somebody who may have been there a little bit longer will have resources and stories to share with the people who are just coming in. It's very supportive and really very educational at the same time.
Yeah.
Within the 6 centers that you have, when men and women and families come in, how are they sheltered? I know that are they sheltered in the same facilities, or are they sheltered differently? How does that process work?
So each of the shelters are separate entities, so we all operate differently or on our own. and each one is set up a little bit differently. So I could talk about Hope House. We are community living, so there's really not a lot of shared or private space. It's all shared space, so very dormitory-style living for us. So people come in, and they are going to be in a room with their family, so their children. So they're going to come in. We don't house abusers. We're just housing victims. So it could be that two or three families are in one room. It could be that a family has a lot. It's a larger family and they have a lot of children, so they may take up a whole room on their own. So it just depends on the size of the family.
Why is it difficult for people to leave a relationship when they have become victims of domestic violence?
Well, it's difficult for a lot of reasons. I think one of the major ones is it's very dangerous to leave a domestic violence situation. I think a lot of times people say, well, why doesn't she just leave? And you're like, well, she did. She did, and this is what happened. So fear and danger is one. Economics is one. It's very difficult if you don't have a job, you have children, don't have an education, you don't have any resources available to you to start over, to start from scratch. It's often hard for a caregiver to leave, take the children away from that. They want their children. I'll speak in terms of, you know, generalities in terms of women being the victims, but you know they don't want their kids to leave their father. They want them to have a life with their father. So that could be a reason. It could be around, I think one of the hardest things that people, it takes to understand domestic violence is that people still love that person. They just want that behavior to stop. They don't want the relationship to stop necessarily. They want that behavior to stop. So that person that they fell in love with, they got into that relationship, they want that person back and the abusive behaviors to go away.
What are some of the red flags in a relationship that both men and women should be aware of?
I think there's a lot of them, and I would say if you're experiencing some of these, that you look at it in totality and you look at your relationship, and if people have questions, to call the hotline and talk about it. But a key one is controlling behavior in the relationship. So are you allowed to come and go as you please? Do you have to report in? Do you have your movements monitored? Is your cell phone being monitored? Is the odometer on your car being monitored? You don't have freedom to come and go. The money is another one. If you don't have access to money, that's being restricted. Your movements are being restricted around money. Obsessive behavior, extreme jealousy, outbursts of violent behavior can be another sign. I think it's also important to remember that domestic violence doesn't have to be physical. Mm-hmm. That's what we think of most often is the physical part of it, but it's also the emotional and the verbal abuse that goes along with that. It could also be sexual abuse. There's we see economic abuse as well. So I think it's important to be aware that just because you're not being hit doesn't mean you're not being abused.
And I would say sometimes that mental abuse can be even more stressful and damaging because it can be carried on for such a longer time, and the victim might feel like, well, I can take it another day. And what it's doing is just diminishing the strength of the victim physically and mentally. And the person, the abuser knows it. And continues to do that because they realize that they're diminishing the physical and mental strength of the victim.
Absolutely. That's mm-hmm. really one of the key components of the control, is knowing how to keep that person under their control, and doing that through words and threats and that emotional abuse is one of the key ways that that happens. And I think self-esteem, it's another reason people don't leave. They don't feel they have the strength. They don't feel they have the ability to do that because they have gotten to such a point where they have no faith in themselves at all.
Kind of like the Stockholm Syndrome, mm-hmm, where absolutely. You fall in love with your abuser, although you probably fell in love first before the abuse.
When you discover you're in a relationship or a situation of domestic violence, why is it important to document what is occurring?
Domestic violence often happens in and behind closed doors, so in the privacy of your home, so there are no witnesses. So you don't have anyone to necessarily corroborate your story. So if you have pictures, if you have texts, if you have emails, messages, those kinds of things, then that can be used as evidence if it goes to court and you're needing to provide the evidence there.
And
Hope House also advocates for those that are victims of domestic violence to make a safety plan. What is a safety plan, and what are things that should be included in that safety plan?
Safety plan is really it's very individualized, so it's going to be around that person and that person's situation. So the advocate's going to sit with them and talk about, whether it's on the phone or in person, talk about what is their situation, what are the things that are happening with them. It's very important to bring family and friends into that so that you can have opportunities if somebody sees you and they know you need help because you've implemented something that you have created in the safety plan. Technology is huge. It's a way to, it can be a safety factor, but it can also be a way that people get tracked. So how is technology used? So you really look at the whole picture, but you're looking at putting things away, grabbing a change of clothes and putting it in the trunk of the car, grabbing important documents, making sure we talk about having a safe word with people, that if you text it or you call someone and you use that safe word, they know you're in trouble and they know to call the police and that you're going to need help.
And I really like the way we're going here, because for anybody out there who is listening and they feel as though they may be in an unsafe environment, you know, you have to kind of come to that realization first, and I can say from experience, but the thing is, you also have to decide if you are going to document things and all of that. You kind of have to get a little smart about what you're doing, smart about your movements, so as not to tip off what you're doing, because that could be dangerous in
absolutely
itself. You know, mm-hmm. So I appreciate that we're talking about the types of things that a person can do as far as keeping a record. If you keep a record, keep it in a safe place. Right. If you're taking pictures, keep your phone locked so those pictures can't be seen. But just, you know, being able to have an act that can't be showing what you're doing, because you're in a dangerous situation and you don't want to make it worse by showing the person that you're trying to do something against what they're trying to do to you.
Absolutely, and I think you bring up a good point in that the act of leaving is often the most dangerous time for someone in a domestic violence situation. So leading up to leaving and just shortly after leaving is really that window of time when someone's in the most danger. So if some, you know, the partner gets wind that they're planning to leave, the violence can escalate. The efforts to maintain that control then go up. And so that's when we see increased level of violence, physical violence. We see stalking happening. And we see anything that had been going on in that relationship as ways to control just being elevated during that time.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it important to review that safety plan with your family, your kids, and friends, but also, you said, keep it in a safe place? Why is it important to do that?
Because you never know when it's going to happen. I think that's when we talk about domestic violence being dangerous and ugly and complicated, the opportunity will arise probably when you're least expecting it. So your kids need to know if the plan is that they're going to, you know, when they hear the word or they see the cue from mom that it's time to go, then they need to be able to go without having a lot of prodding or explanation, that they know that it's time to go. If they're going to be at school, wherever it is that they are. So I think it's important. And that if your safety plan is to go to a family member's house, they need to know that you're coming, and then to put whatever into place so that everybody can stay safe at that time too.
I know sometimes it can be really difficult. From reading you all's website and doing some research, you know, the internet can be your internet, and technology can be your friend, but it can also be your greatest enemy, because you said as in tracking. But you know, in that time, you may not have access to the pictures, the photos. And from looking at that, being a network administrator, you could create an email account where nobody else has that, where you could upload the pictures, you could email your documents to that, so you can have access to that anytime you, or any place. But it's also something that nobody else would have access to, and you maybe give that information to that trusted friend, that let them have that password, so that if something does happen, somebody can have that proof to be able to say, well, maybe we need to start looking in this situation, this direction.
Absolutely, and I think that the more that your family and friends know and are involved in your safety planning, the safer, hopefully, the safer people are going to be, that they have those people on their side advocating for them.
What happens when you're in that position and you're trying to make that safe plan, but the person that you go to isn't really getting it, and they don't really realize that you're in a dangerous position? Do you ever have to deal with those situations as far as how to advise a person when maybe they go to their father and the father doesn't realize what they're talking about, that it's serious like that? What does a person do then? Because that could be very demoralizing, to think that someone in your own family doesn't believe you.
And unfortunately, I think that happens frequently for people. And I don't know, sometimes they're not supportive, and sometimes it's not understanding that. So if we're involved with that person, we're going to try to help them with key points of things that they could say. We are also happy to talk to family members to help explain situations and help get them involved if that's what the person wants from us. But if we're not involved, I think it is important to find that trusted person. So if somebody isn't going to be behind you and isn't going to be your ally, then let's try to find someone else who's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
What is something that a person can do if they're being stalked, intimidated, or harassed while they're at work in this situation? Because I know sometimes it may just happen, and sometimes it happens at home, but then it can expand once they've left that relationship to now they're calling at work. What can they do to get help in that type of situation?
And again, it's going to depend on that person's work situation, but hopefully the supervisor is going to be supportive and understanding. A key part of safety planning is safety planning around work. So if you're going to work and that person is sitting out in the parking lot and waiting for you, then is there a way to change where you park, come in a different entrance? Perhaps there's security that could help walk you out, or a supervisor or coworker could work with you. It's going to depend on how open that person wants to be with their work, and hopefully the work will be as supportive of that as well. But a key component will be to safety plan around how work happens.
You just got ahead of me a little bit. Why is it so vital to change your habits, your patterns and activities when you've been intimidated or harassed, to make it harder for you to find?
Well, I think stalking is a huge piece of what happens in a domestic violence relationship, especially if someone has just left or is leaving. Then we see those efforts really increasing. So if you change your route to work, your route to school, your routine just in general, you can then throw that person off, and hopefully they're not going to be able to find where you are. I think you talked about technology earlier. It's important to make sure that there's not something on your phone tracking where you are. There hasn't been some sort of device put on your car. Really having to look at all of those things, that technology can be our friend, mm-hmm. but in domestic violence situations, it can also be a huge danger as well.
When we talked earlier about creating a safe word when you're in danger, why is that so vital that you can create a safe word? It's just like when your alarm company calls you and they ask you for that one word, so that you, if you give the wrong word, then they know that something is happening, but they don't alert the people in the house. Why is it so vital to create that safe word?
Well, you don't know what's happening at that time. Is the abuser sitting there? Does he have a gun? Is there a weapon involved? Is there a knife to your throat? So I think it's really important to remember that you don't know what's happening at that moment. So if that safe word comes out, then you're not necessarily, the goal would be that you're not alerting the abuser to what's going on, that it would be a word that would be nothing that would draw alarm to that person that you were putting a plan into place, if that makes sense.
If you have children, what is some critical information that they need to know? Why is it important for them to know the safe word, their address, their telephone number, and also how to call 911?
I think that's important just in general life for our children to be able to seek emergency services if they need to. And it's really important if that violence is happening right in your own home that they understand that they have that they can play a part if they need to. I think it's also just important for us to remember that kids internalize a lot of things, and it's often that kids internalize the domestic violence and that it's their fault, that if they would have done something differently. So having them involved in the plan, having them a part of it, reiterating to them, reassuring them that it isn't their fault, that this isn't about their behavior, that can go a long way in helping their healing as well.
What those children see as domestic violence in that household can make them more apt to grow up to be people that practice violence toward their spouses. Why is it important to get children in that situation help so that you can, as you talked about earlier, breaking that cycle?
Well, domestic violence is a learned behavior. So it comes from not just our family situations, but our society as a whole. Society allows domestic violence to happen, and until we say as a society that it's unacceptable, it's going to continue to happen. So if you're also learning that in the home as well, then you are more likely to then become an abuser when you're older, or even become a victim as well. But I think it's important to also remember that just because you witnessed violence doesn't mean you're going to become an abuser. It can also be that those children, if they've gotten help and if they've been supported through that process, then they can be the ones that break the cycle.
Hope House has a hotline, 816-461-4673, that a person can call if they're in danger, need shelter, assistance, or help with safety planning, or somebody to talk to. Why is this critical in helping a person get help?
We are open. Our hotline is there 24 hours a day. So I think it's really important that people know they can call and they can talk. People don't have to come into shelter if they call the hotline. I think that's one of the things we hear often is, if I call, I have to come in. No, we will be there to support you, answer your questions, try to give you as much information and the resources that you need to help you make the best decision for you at this time.
So, Hope House is more than also just a shelter. You all give services. What type of services do you provide for people that come in and that are staying there?
So shelter is just a key piece, one piece of what we do, and not everybody needs the residential safety services of shelter. So we have a very large court advocacy program. We're in 13 courts, really helping people navigate through that process. We have a hospital-based advocacy program, so we're meeting people who access hospital services and are screened and say, yes, I want to talk to an advocate, so we can go out and meet them there. We have a safe visitation center. We can work with people who have to exchange children for visits, or when the non-custodial parent is not allowed to see their children without supervision, we can provide that supervision for them to allow a safe environment for those kids to see their parent. We have legal services for our clients. So really our goal is to meet people where they are and provide services to help them break the cycle wherever they are in the process.
With so many different services being provided, what type of individual, personality is required for your staff to be able to provide these kinds of services?
It's funny, I was just talking to some staff yesterday, mm-hmm. and they said, we all have very different personalities. But the thing that connected all of them was their caring nature. They were passionate about helping people, and that's key. We all have very, very different personalities. Some are loud, and others are very, very quiet, soft-spoken, but everybody has a passion to help other people, and that's what's key.
Mm-hmm. And one other thing, when you were talking about the children and the impact of being in the environment may or may not cause them to repeat the cycle. How does trauma come into play, and how is trauma treated for children or for the victim, the adult victim?
Mm-hmm. So domestic violence, anyone that has experienced domestic violence has experienced trauma. So we do come from a trauma-informed base. Our services are trauma-informed. And that, how we approach people then is we don't say, why are you doing that? Our question to them is, what happened to you and how can we help you now? And that, I think, is where we start with everyone. And I think it's especially with the children as well. Our services that we have around counseling are both for adults and for children. Our philosophy is that the children have experienced that as well. Even if they didn't experience abuse themselves, they witnessed it and they were a part of that environment, and they need just as much support and guidance as the adults do.
We're going to have to take a short break. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Cowtown Conversations, and our topic today is about domestic violence. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break. And we're back. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI. This is Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. And today our guest is the CEO of Hope House. So we were just having an interesting conversation off air, and you posed a question. So pose that question so our listeners can hear it.
Well, often when I'm asked, why doesn't she leave? My response to that really is, the first is, we're asking the wrong question. We really need to be asking, why doesn't the abuser stop abusing and that person leave? And really change our focus as society away from the victim. I think we're often victim blaming instead of looking at holding the perpetrator accountable for their actions. I think if we can do that, then I think we're going to go a long ways in helping to really stop domestic violence from happening at all.
And that perpetrator can be male or female. Domestic violence knows no boundaries. It doesn't know race. It doesn't know sex. You know, and it doesn't have to be also, when we said earlier, it doesn't have to be exactly violence. It can be disparaging words, disparaging terms, you know, way you treat an individual emotionally. So it can be a lot of different things.
That's right.
So one of the things I learned when I was doing this research, that if a person has a cell phone but no active plan, they can use that phone to call 911. Is that correct?
Yes, and that can be key to having somebody get to safety as soon as they possibly can, if they can call for services.
So even if they may have an old cell phone, it's not active, they can, as long as it has juice and they can punch in 911, they can make that phone call.
They should probably check that out first to make sure that that phone will do that, but it should. They should be able to do that, but I would not count on that if you haven't verified
right.
that first. Yeah.
Another thing is, if a person is in a situation where they can't talk, and you state on your website that in some cases they can text 911.
Correct. And that's new. That's a newer piece of safety planning and a newer piece of helping victims, is that being able to text to get the help they need. And that could be to 911, but that can also be to family or friends, or that could be part of the safety plan as well.
So can you text 911 in the Kansas City metropolitan area?
Yes, you can. Yes.
So if you have a question or call, give us a call on our studio line, 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-KKFI. So if you have a question or comment, or just want to, in some cases, tell your story, just give us a call. So if you need a person to talk to in Kansas City, there's also a domestic violence metro hotline. What is that number, ma'am?
It's 816-HOTLINE. And that is the work that we do. The six shelters work together. We have a shared hotline. We take turns answering that throughout the week. So the goal is that no matter where you are in the metro, you can access services. So if you call 816-HOTLINE, and so say Hope House is answering the phone that day and we don't have space, we know where space is available in the network. We know what the other programs offer, that if we aren't able to help, that we can connect them with the other programs. It's a great way for us to work together to make sure that nobody falls through, that we have a safety net across the entire metro.
One of the things, Kansas City is, when I found out when I was serving on the school board, Kansas City is like the United Nations in certain areas. If you go to East High School, there are 57 different languages.
Wow.
When a person may call, do you all have people that can speak to them in a language other than English?
Sometimes we have somebody that can speak to them in there, but if we don't have someone on, we have resources that we can do on the phone. We can access LanguageLine and different resources that we can find out what their language is and then get someone on the phone that can speak their language. It's really surprising the number of different languages that people speak, and it would be hard for any program to have all of them available at all times. So that's where those resources that we can access 24 hours a day are so, so helpful.
You have a question?
When a person calls, I know they probably had to work themselves up to even get on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
What types of things happen? What types of conversations follow once a person finally does make that decision to make that call?
I think the first thing that we're going to do is make sure that person's safe and that they can talk, and find out what their name is. If they want to share their whole name, they can. And then just talk to them. Just ask them what's going on, what do they need, how can we help, It's very supportive, and it's really directed by the person on the phone. If they don't want to talk about a particular situation, they don't have to. We're going to let them guide the conversation.
What are some steps or things that people can do if they're being stalked? You know, how do they begin to document that process to be able to, in the end, may culminate with getting a order of protection or getting the police involved? What can they do?
Well, I think keeping track of those things is really important. We see that happening through texts, through phone messages, through emails. If you can get pictures, that's really helpful, and making reports to the police so that the police have that information and they can help you with that. I think it's really important.
What if the person is just, they don't know where the person lives, but they're just calling their work, leaving harassing, threatening voicemails, you know, a past relationship. What can they do in that situation?
I think, again, just keeping that, don't erase those messages, keep them, and making sure that the police are aware, the law enforcement's aware that those things are happening.
The outstanding work you do would not be possible without some very important people, your volunteers.
Mm-hmm,
can you tell us a little bit about your volunteers?
We have amazing volunteers. So people help us in a wide variety of ways. We have students who are doing their internships with us and learning how to be social workers and counselors. And then we have people who help in our different programs. We have people who help at our events, people who come and do yard work and cleaning and sort out the donation room. And then there's people who do drives and fundraising drives or collect food, collect clothing, collect toiletries and anything you use during the course of the day. We use times 122. Mm-hmm. So people gather those things for us and bring them in. It's the holiday time, so people are doing holiday, getting items for our holiday store so, you know, we can have nice Christmases and Hanukkahs, whatever people celebrate, they can have those traditions continue.
We've got a caller on line one. Elizabeth, can you tell us what part of town you're calling from and what your question is?
I live in Mission, and I was actually just calling in, not so much with a question, but I'm a survivor of domestic abuse, and I actually went into shelter through Safe Home for a while with my children, and it was an amazing experience, and they really helped me get back on my feet and rebuild my life. And so I just kind of wanted to share that and say thank you.
Thank you for calling and sharing your story, because you sharing your story that may convince somebody else right now that's in that situation that there is hope and there is life after domestic violence.
That's right. I really appreciate you sharing that story.
Yeah. I was going to say that they helped me with getting housing, and they helped me with getting custody of my children, and they also helped me emotionally learn how to have a healthy relationship. So it was definitely a great choice, and I'm so grateful.
Can I ask, Elizabeth, what were the skills that you learned as far as having a healthy emotional relationship?
In Safe Home, one of the mandatory things that you needed to do was to do counseling on your own and also with your kids. I had two toddlers at the time. And when I did start dating again, they actually helped me kind of coach and learn how to set up boundaries and how to express my needs. And so long after I had moved out of housing, I still went to counseling services and learned how to have a healthy emotional relationship with my husband now, and we've been together 11 years.
That's really great to hear. Thank you
awesome.
So much.
That's awesome.
Thank you for calling and sharing your story and just giving hope to others.
Thank you.
So there is hope, folks, after domestic violence. And as our caller called in, said, you know, she's 11 years married. And, you know, but it takes sometimes taking that first step. It can be a scary step, but also taking that first step. If someone would like to volunteer at Hope House, what do they need to do? Is there a phone number, a person they can call or contact?
We do have a volunteer manager, but you can call the main number, 816-461-4188, and ask for the volunteer manager. Her name's Anne, and she would be happy to talk with you about what your interests are and how you'd like to get involved.
A lot of people who leave in a healthy relationship in many cases leave with just the clothes on their back, and they need help starting to rebuild their lives. It's the holiday season. People are cleaning out. But you also have to remember, sometimes it's more blessed to give than to receive. What can people do to donate to Hope House?
We have, I think, the needs are great that we have right now. We are looking at the holiday store, so we provide holiday gifts for both the kids to give to moms and moms to give to their kids. So we're looking for those new items to go into that store. We are always in need of food, toiletries. We never have enough toilet paper. We could always use, paper towels, those kinds of things. Anything, again, anything you use during the course of the day. And you just need to call that number, that 461-4188, and we can talk to you about how you're able to get those to us.
And you say, are they all new items as far as clothing and things like that?
We have to, we don't have to just take new items when it comes to clothing. But the problem is we don't have a lot of storage space, so you really need to call ahead of time and talk about what it is that you have to make sure that we can take it.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, our storage is very limited, so we can only take certain things at certain times, so we have to put a hold on it at times. So I would call first.
And what's that number again for them to call if they want to donate to see if it's something you'll be able to take?
816-461-4188. That's our main number, and then it'll direct you to how to, with whatever your question is, it'll direct you to the right person.
If an organization or group would like to have someone from Hope House come out and speak to the group, is that something the Hope House does? And how would they contact you all to have a speaker come out?
We do that. It's really important that education is a key component of the work that we do. So it's that same number, and you would just listen to the prompts. And our volunteer manager, Ann, is also the one that coordinates our speakers as they go out to those different organizations.
Well, I know with our last caller, that was really a great representation of the type of breaking the cycle can happen. I guess I was wondering, she said, you know, she came in and had to start all over. Once you have a victim who's now a survivor and she's got that mentality, what are the types of things that you're able to help them get so that they can get back into the community and start life over again, as far as like housing and things like that?
We try to help people with whatever their needs are. Unfortunately, our resources are as limited as to what is available. So housing is the number one need that people have when they come into shelter, for sure. Everyone that comes into shelter is homeless. So, but we don't have a lot of housing available. So it can be tricky and it can be time consuming. It can take a long time. We connect with as many resources as we can, but we don't have housing available to just give to people when they come in. So mm-hmm. we're going to get them on lists and work with the community who also has housing available that they can, you know, get where they can as soon as possible. But we do the best we can in trying to get people what they need. And if we don't offer that, then we're going to connect with community resources that do and try to get that as soon as possible to them.
So that makes me wonder, how long can a person stay with Hope House if they are in a situation where they just don't have any place else to go?
We don't have a set length of stay. So our philosophy is everyone's situation is very different and it takes a different amount of time based on their situation. So we're going to work with that person and set goals. As soon as they come in, they're going to tell us what it is that they want to work on, and they're going to be working on that. It could take someone a couple of weeks. It could take someone a few months. So we don't want to be putting obstacles in place. So it just depends on the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In some cases, the person returns back to that situation. What is something that a person should consider before returning back to the situation where there was violence in a relationship?
I think one of the first things that we talk to people about is making sure that safety plan is in place. And then talking to them about what is their, I call it the line in the sand. What is your line in the sand that you know that if that line gets crossed, then it's time for you to go? That you are very clear about what your boundaries are going to be. We talk a lot about boundaries in domestic violence situations, and that you be very clear about what that boundary is for you, and that you have the plan in place should it be needed again.
So we've talked that people can use a cell phone, can they, you know, to call 911, but can they talk or text to someone at Hope House or one of the other domestic violence shelters? Do you all have a text line that people can text in questions or things like that?
We don't at this time. We're not set up at the, unfortunately, I think that's one of the things we'd love to be able to do, but we are not set up at this point with that technology to be able to take in texts at this time.
Do you have an email address?
No, the emails are not monitored 24 hours a day. The mm-hmm. best way to reach someone is to call that 461-HOPE, 816-461-HOPE, or the 816 hotline. That is monitored and answered 24 hours a day. If you try to reach out through other avenues, through email or through social media, you're not necessarily going to get an immediate response because they're not monitored 24 hours a day.
Hope House has a phenomenal website.
Thank you.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about it? You have buttons on there that will help you connect to somebody, create a safety plan. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about your website, but also give that website for anyone that may be listening?
Our website is hopehouse.net. We were very grateful to be able to receive help from VML, a local company, to help us redo our website, and we're very pleased with that, and we want it to be as informative as possible and as give as much information as we can. So go to hopehouse.net. There's a ton of information in there, that educational resources, the numbers to call and how you can reach us, ways to get involved. There's just all sorts of information there that whether you're a survivor needing help or if you're wanting to get involved to help, it can help you with both of those.
So does Hope House help if the male or female comes in that's looking to get help to kind of talk? Is there places or situations where people can come in Kansas City to get help that may be the abuser themselves? What resources are available for those people that may want to truly get help and turn their lives around and reconnect with their family?
Absolutely. The program north of the river called Synergy Services, they offer a batterer's intervention program, and they do phenomenal work. They're very, very good at that. So I would call that. I don't know that number right off the top of my head, but that 816 hotline, they would be able to give it to you, or you could just go to Synergy Services website and look that up there.
We've talked about so much today, and before we end, is there any other questions or comments or something that you'd like to say to those that may be in a domestic violence situation or maybe contemplating leaving a domestic violence situation?
I would say to people who are in need of services or thinking about it, just call and we'll talk with you. You don't have to make a decision today. You could just get information and you can just get support. You can just have someone on the other end who will listen and be non-judgmental and really be able to walk through with you what your options are. And if you choose to stay, we will support you in that and just want you to be as safe as possible.
And in calling, you may not get the answer that you're looking for right then, but it'll give you the strength and the courage to maybe call back.
That's
you
right.
know, and so calling back, you'll kind of have in your mind maybe a process or what might be more helpful, what might be the question to ask. So that one, that first call can do a lot to help you get on the road to solving that situation for yourself.
That's right. Thank you for saying that.
I would like to thank Marianne for being our host and being our guest today on Cowtown Conversations, and we're never in Cowtown Conversations without a community minute. Tonight, the Kansas City Public Schools will host the second school board school for anyone interested in running for the Kansas City Public School Board of Directors in April 2019. The event will be held at the Board of Education Building, 2901 Troost Avenue. It will start at 5 p.m. and end at 8 p.m. For more information or to make a reservation to attend, contact Julie Kluckmeyer, Board Secretary, at 816-418-7621. And tomorrow morning, Friday, will be the 6th District City Council meeting. It will be held at the Trailside Center, 9901 Holmes Road, and will start at 7:30 a.m. and go from until 9 o'clock p.m. Center will be arriving at East Patrol tomorrow, which is located at 2640 Prospect Avenue, tomorrow evening from 6 to 8 p.m. He'll be in the community room. We'll have hot chocolate, coloring books, and candy canes for children. So if you have a child, bring them out to welcome Santa. On Monday, December 17th, Bluefield Library will host a Cookies and Cocoa event at Bluefield Library, 3050 Prospect Avenue, from 5:30 to 7 p.m. The event will include an appearance from Santa, cookies, and a cocoa bar. Last meeting on the city housing plan will be held December 19th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Guadalupe Center, 1015 Cesar Chavez Boulevard. Come out if you're interested in hearing about the city's housing plan for the next 5 years. Also, Hy-Vee, the police department, and Harvesters will be doing a Christmas hymn giveaway December 19th from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. in East Patrol, 2640 again Prospect. It's first come, first serve. There will be no holding of anything. So the line will, last year they gave out over 500, so the line will probably form early and long. Join us next week, and our guest will be Dr. Mark Bedell, superintendent of the Kansas City Public School District, and we'll be talking about education and education opportunities and what is going on with the school district now. For Cowtown Conversations, I've been your host, Joseph Jackson, and our intern, Marbita. Have a great day, and stay tuned for My Place with Larry J. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Streaming online at